Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
in... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hey, this is not Chuck, and this surely is not Julie. It's Mark Poff again, guest hosting for Chuck and Julie. Hopefully, they are having a wonderful time down in Arizona playing golf. Hopefully, Chuck's out playing golf with his son. I don't know if Julie plays golf or not, but I have to tell you, when my kids were in high school, I used to constantly take my kids down to Arizona to watch spring training. So I hope they're having a great time. I hope it's nice and warm for them. So let me tell you what we're going to do today and what we're going to do Wednesday. Hopefully it'll be entertaining. I'm going to be monitoring the chat stuff. Hopefully I'll catch that. If you want to ask any questions or confront me, debate me, whatever, I'm all about debate. Please call me out if you think I'm saying something that's wackadoodle. And I'll be more than happy to explain my views, or I might even capitulate and say, you know what, maybe you're right. So if you want to call in, it's 888-627-6008. If you want to talk to me, I believe the procedure is to just unmute and start talking to me. You can interrupt. I don't care. I'm pretty easygoing. So here's what we're going to do for today. Now, I'm just Mark Poff, a retired detective with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office down here in El Paso County. I was a computer engineer for 20 years, then went into law enforcement. I do computer forensics, cell phone forensics, worked on over 80 death investigations, over 100 death investigations, all kinds of felonies, had a great time as a detective. And on Wednesday, which could be really tricky for John and I, we're going to talk about, is the judicial system fair? And we're going to talk about specifically here in Colorado. And I'm sure a bunch of you are like, no, it's not fair. John and I both worked for law enforcement agencies. I as a detective, he was a commander of investigations. So he was very used to leading an investigation, supervising an investigation, and then seeing it through a trial process. I've testified numerous times for the prosecution and homicides and all kinds of major cases. I've testified for the defense in homicides and all types of cases. I've actually won some homicide cases for the well, I didn't win, but I've been on cases that have been had positive resolutions. And obviously, I've worked for the prosecution on convictions for homicides as well. So from that standpoint, we're going to talk Wednesday, and it should take the whole day for the most part, just talking about some of the things we've seen now working for the defense for the last 8 years, predominantly the defense. I've been retained a few times for prosecution. I've still testified for prosecution since I've retired, but mainly for defense attorneys. Some of the things we've seen that are kind of interesting being on the other side of the court now and then coming up with this, you know, is the whole system fair? Does it work fair for those that have been accused of cases? So we're going to talk about that on Wednesday. So today, John's going to get on about 3:20, so about 15, 20 minutes, and we're going to transition over and talk about the Murdaugh case. I think it's very interesting to talk about the whole family. I mean, this is no longer just Alex Murdaugh and this double homicide of his wife and his son. It's also very interesting about this whole family. I mean, geez, man, it's dangerous to be their friends. And if you have relationships with them, you know, you could just end up dead. So we're going to talk about that in some of the cases. And John and I also talked about Murdaugh a while back. And I believe I actually made the statement that I thought social media and cell phone records could play a part in the case, which it has. And we'll do that about 20 minutes to 25 minutes after the hour. But first, again, I am no political expert. Chuck and Julie are just phenomenal. I love to watch them. I kind of stay out of politics when it comes to law enforcement because I believe that law enforcement and politics really should not intermix, which unfortunately, it appears that it's doing a lot here lately. Now, it always has played a little bit of a role in some of your major cases when politicians get themselves in trouble or they're being viciously attacked or falsely accused. And that's unfortunate. Law enforcement should be pretty straightforward from the standpoint of, did you do something wrong? Is there evidence that you did something wrong? And it should go through the process without any politics. We should not be pulling people over and saying, I'd like to see your driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, and your voter registration card. So district attorneys and cops should not be making decisions based on anybody's political views, opinions, or whatever. It should be strictly down to the facts. What happened? What is the evidence in this case? Don't politicize it. And then prosecute if there is probable cause that a crime's been committed. So I'm going to about to tackle what I think is probably the most, challenging thing to try to have a conversation and not politicize. When we talk about January 6th, there's so many political views, and I get it. I understand it completely. And I have to tell you, you know, I saw these videos that were controlled, and that's one of my issues, by the Democrats, by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. We saw what they wanted us to see. And then the Republicans take over. And now, you know, McCarthy released the videos to Tucker Carlson. And I wish he kind of just released it to everybody. Just let it out there. Full transparency. Whoever wants to go through 40,000 hours of video, God bless you. Go for it. You know, and if you want to look through all the video and see what you can find, I'm all for that. And again, videos are probably one of the best forms of testimony, if you want to call it that, so long as it hasn't been manipulated. And you also need to hear the audio. And that's very important to me that we get to hear the audio. Now, I've not had the time, nor am I interested, to be honest with you, in going through all this video and the audio. I still have a job to do. I am swamped with work, having a great time with what I'm doing. But I really do like that Tucker Carlson has released the video. But I understand, as a realist, as a prior law enforcement, that Tucker Carlson has an agenda as well. And so understand that he probably cherry-picked. We know Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats cherry-picked what video we got to see for 2 years. And now Tucker's showing us what he wants us to see. And I get that. The truth of what really happened on January 6th is probably somewhere in the middle. But I think it's important to understand what are the facts around January 6th. This is the kind of the way that I look at it. First off, you know, how many people were there? You know, and they showed up to what is completely legal. So let's just kind of go through the whole timeline of January 6th. So a group shows up and they listen to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is giving a speech. Now, I have not seen the whole speech. And I guess for me to really talk about Donald Trump's speech, I need to be able to see the whole thing. I did not. I saw what they wanted me to see. But I didn't see anything from any of the videos of what Donald Trump said where he said anything to incite a riot. I didn't see it. In fact, to me, it sounded pretty, you know, go down to the Capitol, which we need to understand. The march to the Capitol, and I think everybody knows this, was already pre-planned. So it was not that Trump somehow announced, go to the Capitol, you know, and do whatever. That never happened. They were planning on going down to the Capitol building. They had already registered to have a protest down there. They were all set. They knew they were coming. And so after he was done talking, he said, go peacefully, go down to the Capitol and have your voices heard. Nothing wrong with that. So I don't personally see, from my standpoint in law enforcement, anything that gives me the view that Donald Trump incited anything. And I don't really like the whole fact of he should have done more. Okay, he's not responsible for other people's actions. You know, I get all that, whole different conversation. So how many people were there? I tried to go find out this number. Anywhere from 25,000 to 100,000. Sounds like a lot of people are agreeing somewhere between 75,000 and 100,000 people might have been down at the mall area or near the Capitol building during all this time. So let's go through the facts of what happened. Now, we've all seen the videos where there's confrontation with police. I get that. They had barricades. People went through the barricades. Is that right? No. But when you compare it to what happened with the George Floyd riots that summer, it's not even close. It's not even the same league as to what happened with all the protests that were going on the year or so prior to that. And I get it. People were upset. They went through barricades. They ultimately, some made mistakes and went into the Capitol. So out of, let's say, 80 to 100,000, how many went into the Capitol? no one seems to have all the facts of what is the number. But based on what was out there and released by different organizations, it appears, and I'm going to get to this whole National Guard stuff, it appears about 2,000 people, around that number, entered the Capitol building. Wow. So if you had 80,000 to 200 or 80,000 to 100,000 people, 2,000 entered. Okay, it doesn't sound like a large number of people. Sounds like the vast majority of the people stayed outside. So could we call this a mostly peaceful protest? I think we could. So let's talk about damage here real quick, and then I'll get back to some of these charges. So the original estimate, if you listen to the media, which is total BS, that night or the next day, they said that there was about $30 million worth of damage. Completely not true. When the first original estimate came out, it was about $1.5 million worth of damage. And if you think about it, that's really not that much. There was about, with the George Floyd, about $2 billion worth of damages, and 18 people were deaths that were contributed to those protests. So that's the facts. And again, I'm all about the facts. I'm not trying to get political about this. So the last estimate that's been given out on the damage was about $2.7 million in damages to the Capitol building. Now, I've yet to see a video showing anyone in the rotunda pulling statues over or ripping up, you know, knifing million-dollar paintings. I didn't see any of this. In fact, in one of the videos that I saw somebody pick something up and set it back on a table. So I think there'd be a good argument for the fact that people were not in the Capitol building to, A, destroy things, even though there was some destruction. The vast majority of the people that entered the Capitol, based on the video that I've seen, were not there to hurt anybody, and they were not there to damage anything. So, but they did go in, and that was a problem. Now, I have an issue, if you want to call it entrapment or whatever, I have an issue because it appears that once they came in, the Capitol Police were like, hey, would you like a little tour? We'll walk with you while you walk through the Capitol building. They should have been yelling and screaming the whole time, you need to get out. You're trespassing. You are violating federal law. And again, that's why the audio is so important. But again, it just, to me, it doesn't seem like a riot. Now there are videos, mainly outside. There are some videos that definitely show stuff that I'm not happy with and I'm not thrilled with. So let's talk about the numbers again, the facts of what happened on January 6th. So I got the numbers here. Sorry that I'm going to be looking down at my cards, but I'm old and can't remember things as good as I used to. Were any arrested for taking weapons into the Capitol? Let's talk about the numbers. I think I'm going to address that a little bit. So they believe there was about 2,000 people that entered the Capitol, and this is using their own numbers. So I'm not going out on the internet and look at that. This is what they say. 1,000 were charged. About 1,000 were charged. So 1,000 out of 100,000. Okay. 640 were charged for entering the Capitol building. Okay. Originally, 60 were arrested for assaulting a peace officer. So 60 individuals were arrested for assaulting peace officers, 26 felony obstruction or interfering. So that's kind of some of the numbers. So let's talk about this. Let me see. Out of all these numbers, when they talk about plea deals, there's been 508 that have already pled guilty, 133 felonies, 385 misdemeanors. There's been 60 felony convictions or pleas for assault on a peace officer. Okay. If they assaulted a peace officer and there's facts to that, I get it. So were there weapons coming in? So there was some people that were 45 were charged with destruction of government, 35 for theft. I know I have this somewhere. Okay, 75 people were charged using deadly or dangerous weapons or causing serious bodily injury to an officer. Now, let me explain this to you. So when I first read that, I say 75 charged with using deadly weapon. Oh, 75 had deadly weapons. No, that's the thing about what the DOJ or Capitol Police is putting out in this, in their websites, is they keep putting ors out there. So if I say that, you know, 100 people were charged with felony assault or littering, okay, what does that really tell me? You know, so they do, but they put these ors in here on these charges that I think are a lot less than what the original one. So right here, it says that 326 were arrested for assault, resisting, or obstruction. To me, there's a big difference between obstruction and assaulting a peace officer. But they put these ors in between, so you think, oh, okay. So when I say 75 were charged with using a deadly weapon or dangerous weapon or causing SBI to an officer, well, it could be that they didn't have any dangerous weapon on them at all, but maybe they hit an officer, which understand that when you talk about assaulting a peace officer in most states, and I can only really talk with intelligence when it comes to Colorado, if you punch a cop and that's it, you punch him. Actually, in Colorado, if you threaten to use deadly force against a cop, you threaten, you don't even have to use it, it's first degree assault. So it could be that someone took maybe they had a flag on a stick and they accidentally hit a cop and hurt him or something. Who knows? I don't want to get in between people's ears and knowing what's going through their brains. But my question would be, and very simply, how many people took deadly weapons into the Capitol? You can't get the number. It's not out there. So you have to wonder when they put these ors, you know, they had deadly weapons or were littering. Or loitering. In the, I mean, you're sitting there going, which is it? Give me the actual numbers. And they don't really do this. So again, that concerns me that they're not really talking about this. Now, a question here is entering on invitation. We've all seen the videos that Tucker Carlson showed, or many of us, that show the individual that was inside the Capitol for 38 seconds. I get this. It seems like from the video, he walks in much later. Now, see, here's my point. If somebody breaks down the door to get into the Capitol, I get it. Those people up front that broke the doors to go into the Capitol. The Capitol Police should have grabbed them immediately, restrained them, and arrested them. Now, the others in the back would have been like, okay, that's not good. As soon as they went through, these guys started hitting them with nightsticks. They started, you know, doing whatever. And then, you know, the others would have been like, okay, that's not a good move. But if you go through and then you got Capitol Police sitting back, hey, welcome to the Capitol. You're not supposed to be here, but that's cool. Come on in. We'll give you tours. So you got to understand that there was a little bit of entrapment going on there. I don't know. I wasn't there. I haven't heard what was going on in the Capitol. So this guy walks in, walks up. If you watch the video, it looks like he walks up to a Capitol policeman and says something to him. And he says something. And I think one actually points to the door. So maybe somebody did tell him, you know, you're really trespassing by an in here. You shouldn't be in here. Well, then he turns around and walks out. Okay, sounds to me like he did the right thing. So why is he even being charged? You can't say that he knowingly entered the Capitol building and knew that it was an issue until someone tells him what you're doing is wrong. You need to leave. We don't know if he busted down a barricade to get to that point. We need more video evidence to understand that. I definitely agree with this last statement from Jim. If there had been guns and knives brought out, you know, we would have had video by now. You don't think Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats wouldn't have shown us the video already? I think there's a good argument to say, if there ain't video at this point of it, it probably didn't happen. I somewhat agree with that. So let's move on. I'm spending way too much time on this. Let's talk about deaths. This is something that I've heard so much about. How many people actually died due to the riot? There was a few that died of natural causes, and they were Trump supporters that were marching. Well, let me tell you something. If you get a bunch of middle-aged people and you tell them to march, if you've ever gone to D.C. and walked from the White House to the Capitol, it's not a simple little walk. It's a little bit longer, you know, depending on people's health. Some people are going to have some medical issues. It's going to happen. I'm sorry for what happened to them, but they don't count. You know, the original statement was the night of the January 6th, is that up to 10 people died because of the riots. Well, okay, that's not true. So let's talk about the who died and how they died based on this. Now, I saw something here recently where they were dedicating, this was actually in the Capitol, where they're ringing a bell and reading people's names in law enforcement of people that died because of January 6th. So I'm going, whoa, they're ringing this bell a lot of times. You know, it's like five times. I'm like, I never knew this. And to be honest with you, I didn't know. So I actually was like, I thought there was one guy that originally they said got hit with a fire extinguisher, but later on said that he died of natural causes because of a stroke the next day. So I was confused. So I looked into this. So Brian Sicknick, he's the one that Tucker Carlson was showing so much walking around after they said he got hit by a fire extinguisher. My question would be, if there's video of him getting hit with a fire extinguisher or someone else could testify that he got hit by a fire extinguisher, do you not think that we wouldn't have already had that testimony during the January 6th commission? We would have already known, you know, that here's what happened. So I found in my research that Brian Sicknick died of natural causes, and Capitol Police admit to that. He died of natural causes. So there's a total of five that they say are from January 6th. There's four more who committed suicide. So within 3 days, there was one person who committed suicide. And according to his spouse, he was never the same since January 6th. I get that. Several days later, there was another suicide. Then there was two more suicides that were 6 months later, after January 6th. One of the suicides that they're contributing to January 6th, directly, you know, contributing from January 6th, was someone who wasn't even there. He wasn't even there for the riots. He got called in later that night after it was all over, said and done. He had no exposure to the riot whatsoever. And they're giving him, I don't want to say credit, but they're saying that he committed suicide because of January 6th. You know, when you say stuff like that, you lose all credibility. You lose complete credibility about what actually happened. So was anybody, and here's the key. The coroner decides how people die. And there's only five ways you can die. One of which is homicide, suicide, natural causes, accidental, or undetermined. So there was only one homicide on January 6th that was registered by the coroner as a homicide. And that is Ashley Babbitt. Homicide, the definition of homicide is the taking of a life by another. So it's not a suicide. Ashley Babbitt died inside the Capitol building. She was shot, they say, in the shoulder. I heard it was in the neck. Doesn't matter. She bled out and she died. So let's talk about that. They've already concluded that this was a good shooting. Now, I don't like this whole term, good shooting. I never have. You've heard me say this before. They've deemed it a legal shooting. And by all standards of what happened, even if you watch the video, which I have multiple times, per their definition, that was a legal shooting. Do I like it? No. I was actually in a scenario where I had an individual on a traffic stop pull an assault rifle on me. I could have just shot him dead immediately, and I would have been justified. I did not. I took the weapon from him hands to hand. So I took it from him, and that I resolved it that way. That was my decision that I felt in that scenario when this guy was trying to pull an assault rifle on me, that I could get the upper hand, and I could take the assault rifle from him, and I didn't have to shoot anybody. If you watch the video, it's very clear that Lieutenant Michael Byrd, who did the shooting, Capitol Police, did not need to shoot her. That is my personal opinion. Also, it was a very dangerous shooting on his part. If you actually watch the video and pay attention to when she's going through the window, am I justifying her going through the window? Absolutely not. I would not in any situation. She was unarmed. She was not posing a threat. Not her individually. Maybe he was scared because of the other people. But here's the part that I don't understand. If you actually watch the video, there are 3 to 4 armed Capitol Police with assault rifles standing right next to Ashley Babbitt. Okay, I'm confused. Why aren't they doing anything? They're standing there with assault rifles. If the one officer, Michael Byrd, is authorized in shooting her, an unarmed female coming through a window, why isn't these 3 Capitol Police completely legal and just pulling out their assault rifles and just shooting everybody down? So how come that didn't happen? Because those policemen were under restraint and they understood that these people were not posing a threat to them. Nobody touched them. No one attacked them. No one was threatening them. But when Michael Byrd, when he pulled that trigger and shot Ashley Babbitt, there was a Capitol Police officer standing right next, a little behind her. If he had missed, because he hit her in the shoulder, if he had missed, there was a good chance that he could have shot a fellow Capitol policeman right in the face. So legally, do they consider this to be a justified or legal shooting? Yes, they did. They've made this decision. I'm not going to argue with them. They went through all the evidence, supposedly. I'm telling you, it was dangerous. It was not safe what he did, nor do I believe in watching the video that he needed to do what he did. He could have just pushed her back through the window and just, again, why weren't the other Capitol Police doing anything? They were standing right next to them. These are all questions that perplex me. So let's talk about damages. I already talked about damages. I already told you about George Floyd. So I'm going through all my cards. Okay, so let's get to what really, I think, kind of gets down. We all have opinions on, you know, whether she should or should not have been shot. I have my opinion, but I want to try to keep this non-political. And I'm actually spending more time than I thought, so I'm going to have to apologize to John. When Tucker Carlson released these videos, the most important part about that is he showed us an other side of the story, the other side of the coin. He showed us that there was more to this than what Nancy Pelosi was allowing us to see. So for 2 years, we could not see anything as a public unless Nancy Pelosi wanted us to see it. Is that full transparency? Hell no. Right now, in most agencies, when something happens, they have a week to 10 days to release all the body cams from the law enforcement officers that were involved. My question is, how come none of the Capitol Police have body cams? That's a surprise. Should have been body cams on everyone. That's what they want, is body cams on all law enforcement. So if they want to be truly transparent, Nancy Pelosi had a week to 10 days to release all the videos. Didn't happen. So guess who's not being transparent? They only wanted you to see what they wanted you to see. So they all know about the big guy wearing the big hat, the Shannon, whatever they call him. I don't know his name, nor am I interested that much in him. Here's my concern with that whole scenario. He made a decision to take a plea bargain for, I guess, right around 4 years in federal prison for what he did. Okay, he made a decision under guidance from his attorney. Now it turns out he was not provided all the video in the Capitol. He could only use for his defense or his decision process in making the decision to take a plea based on video that was incomplete. He did not, nor did his defense team, have access to all the video and audio that was available to him. That is a discovery violation. That is not appropriate behavior in the United States. You are obligated as a prosecutor to provide all the discovery to the defense so they can make a decision, an intelligent decision. That's my biggest issue in a lot of this is you are limiting discovery and doing discovery violations, which is my biggest issue working predominantly for defense now. You've got to provide them with all of the discovery that you're going to be used at trial. I constantly, in working on cases, a week before trial, a week, the prosecution will say, oh, we got more evidence. And it's like, you're telling me you didn't have this before, that you just figured this out a week before trial. And they're not being completely honest about this. So it's very important if you're going to build confidence in America of our elected officials, you have to be fully transparent. They didn't release the name of the officer, Michael Byrd, Lieutenant Michael Byrd with the Capitol Police, for 8 months after the shooting. If this, and he shot an unarmed female. Facts are the facts. If this had happened anywhere else and you had an agency saying, we're not even going to tell you who the officer was who shot that unarmed individual during an event, do you not think that things would go crazy? But they did it. And we're sitting by and just letting this happen. So to me, what's important is that everybody's treated the same. It doesn't matter who they are, whether it's a riot on the Capitol or a riot at a federal building out in Portland. You got to treat everybody the same. You got to give them the same bail. You got to treat them the same going into court. Doesn't matter what their political views are. So here, real briefly, and John, I apologize. I'm going about 10 minutes over my time here. I want to talk very briefly about Donald Trump. And I told Chuck and Julie, I said, you know, something will happen by Monday or Wednesday that will change what it is we're going to talk about or what I'm going to talk about. Well, Donald Trump announced over the weekend that he had gotten intel. Actually, One last thing I do want to cover before I move on. I just thought of this. You need to watch the Michael Byrd interview if you have 30 minutes to waste. He makes a statement. He makes a few statements that I found very interesting, talking about the shooting and everything that happened, or the riot that happened at the Capitol. He said that they had no intel that there was going to be any large protest at the Capitol. What? They had to know they were coming. Nancy Pelosi knew they were coming. And someone asked, how come they didn't get the National Guard? I think, I'm not completely sure, that there was some intel about, you know, a large crowd and that you need more agents, more officers there. Michael Byrd says that when they went to their briefing that morning for that day, they were down to 1/3 of normal staff. So not only did they not get more officers because they knew this event was going to happen today, they had only 1/3 of what they normally have. He said this in the interview. So to me, it almost sounds like they were enticing, and actually they were putting officers at risk by not giving them enough to protect themselves. Nancy Pelosi had an opportunity to get the National Guard, turned it down. And so there's a lot of other issues there about January 6th, about did the Democrats let it happen because they wanted it to happen? I don't know. Again, that hopefully will come out in the future. So let's talk about Donald Trump real quick. And I always talk about the fact that I try to stay neutral. And so I say this about Donald Trump about me. Most people either hate Donald Trump or love Donald Trump. And that's Republicans. You can say that. There's Republicans who hate Donald Trump. I get it. I am right in the middle. I loved his administration, but sometimes he said things that drove me crazy. So I really consider myself down the middle when it comes to how I feel about Donald Trump. So he announced that he could be arrested tomorrow. And if he is, I'm sure there'll be something I say on Wednesday. To me, obviously, the first question, is this politically motivated? No kidding. It's absolutely politically motivated. The Democrats cannot help themselves when it comes to the, what is it, Trump derangement syndrome. They just can't help themselves on going after Trump even after he's out of office. What I would say, if you really want to understand this better, do you remember John Edwards? You know, go review everything that happened to John Edwards in this situation and stuff. And ultimately, when they tried to prove that he used all this campaign finance money to pay off a woman that he got pregnant, that it came back with not guilty. And he supposedly spent $1 million with slush money to her. It's like, you're wasting our time, guys. So my concern is how is this arrest going to go down? So he has to have Secret Service, armed Secret Service with him at all time. If they're going to book him into a jail or whatever they want to do, because they got to get the mugshot, they got to do the booking. Someone said, are they going to handcuff him? For God's sakes, why would you need to handcuff him? But we'll see what they do if this actually transpires. So if he goes into a jail, which doesn't allow any weapons in a jail, I'm assuming he's not going to. But the whole time he's in a booking process, he's going to have armed security around him with law enforcement that's armed trying to arrest him. I just don't see how that's going to work out. This whole thing appears to be a circus, a timing. It's an incredibly weak case. They don't even know if they have statute of limitations. And here's the key to talk about this. Again, trying to talk about it as a non-political standpoint. Do you think there's any chance this is going to be adjudicated or resolved before the next election? There's not a prayer. John Edwards took forever for that thing to finally get resolved. So when we go into election day in November of 2024, this will still be pending. It'll be out there. And the question is, and you guys would know this better than me, do you think this whole thing will help Donald Trump or hurt Donald Trump? I think it will. It could potentially galvanize his support. So I think they may be shooting themselves in the foot. They're going to make him a victim. They're going to make him a martyr for the cause. And you know, they think, you know, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I just think the whole thing is just basically a cluster, and it's obviously politically motivated. So that's it. That's my whole January 6th and Donald Trump talk. It is what it is. We'll see how a lot of this stuff plays out. So at this point, I'd like to bring in John St. Augustine to have a completely non-political conversation, because I know John's not interested in that. So if you could bring John into this, I believe I saw him on the list. If you could unmute and turn on your video, John, I can barely see your head. If you can turn your screen down a little bit. So everybody remembers John St. Augustine. Again, I worked for John for many years. I was the detective solving crime, and he was the supervisor taking credit for my work. So that's not true. But, you know, we had discussed that today we'd like to spend a little time talking about Murdaugh. And this really happened to interest me because I believe, John, I can't remember 100%. I thought we said that social media, which always, like in the knifing up in Idaho, I think social media and call detail records, cell phone records, technology is really going to play into bringing his prosecution. But so what are your thoughts on the whole Alex Murdaugh trial and then anything else about the Murdaugh family? It appears to be, I don't know, like the Godfather family or something going on out there.
Yeah. Well, first, Mark, thanks for having me on. You should see me. I'm in a coat. I think I'm fighting a bug. It's funny.
COVID.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't, I haven't been sick in a while and I went and got shots to prevent me from getting sick. And here I am.
Oh,
sick. Imagine that. So for, you know, if all the listeners remember, Mark and I actually were asked to do a guest spot. It was late June, early July of 2021. And why we did, you know, at the time, you know, I was telling Mark, I said, there's this really interesting case that's coming out of South Carolina. And for those of you that don't know much about the Alex Murdaugh case, basically he was accused of and recently convicted of killing his wife, Maggie, and their son, Paul. It's in what's called the Low Country of South Carolina. But a little bit of background. So the Murdaugh family had over a century of influence in the Low Country. The equivalent of what would be the elected DA here in Colorado, they had what's called a solicitor in South Carolina. And they found that the family, very extensive, very affluent, very influential. But what came up was back in June of 2021, the wife and the daughter end up dead. Well, as I started to look in this case, you know, there's murders, unfortunately, that happen all around the country every day. But what was interesting about this case was that there was some other things, some other deaths that actually happened prior to the June 7th, 2021 murder of Alex and Maggie Murdaugh. So kind
okay,
of
you're messing some names up here just that because you said daughter too.
So just no, I'm sorry. It's his wife and his son. So
it's Maggie and Paul.
Paul Murdaugh.
Alex is the dad.
Alex is the dad. He has another son named Buster. So the Maggie and Alex had two kids.
Oh, Paul, got it. My bad. Yeah,
had Paul and Buster. But let me give you guys a little bit of a timeline of some other things that were going on. So in 2015, there was a death of a young man named Stephen Smith. Initially, what happened in that particular case was that they said that this kid who had some type of interaction with Buster Murdaugh, that kid had died as a result of a car accident. What was interesting about that case was that the actual people who investigate traffic accidents, so the South Carolina State Patrol, was not allowed to go in and investigate this particular case. What's also interesting is that it is alleged that the Murdaugh family were actually at the crime scene when Stephen Smith was found in the middle of some rural road. So that happens in 15. Fast forward a few years, in 2018, the maid, housekeeper for the Murdaugh family, a gal by the name of Gloria Satterfield, she ends up dead. And what is alleged in that case is that she had tripped down a set of stairs and ends up dead. That she allegedly may have tripped over a dog. She was elderly. She ends up dead. Now, what happens is that Alex Murdaugh, okay, the guy accused of killing his wife and his son, was an attorney who represented Satterfield's estate in basically filing a lawsuit and actually winning a very large judgment of approximately $4.3 million. Now, what's interesting about that is that Murdaugh actually is the one that collected all the proceeds.
Right.
None of the money actually went to the two sons of Gloria Satterfield. So that was a 2018 case. And then in 2019, another murder happens of a young lady named Mallory Beach. Well, Mallory Beach happens to be on a boat that the now, you know, deceased Paul Murdaugh, his son, was driving this boat, had been drinking all night. Video surveillance shows him at various bars, shows him actually purchasing some alcohol using a fake ID. He gets into a boat accident where people are ejected from the boat, and Mallory Beach's body is not found till days after she actually gets out of the actually is ejected from the boat. So then we move on to 2021. So in the span of about just over six years, we have five deaths. Just a completely, you know, interesting case. I mean, if you're looking at it from a law enforcement perspective, you can see how the political influence, right, within that community, how Stephen Smith's murder was never really investigated. In fact, I will tell you, as of, I believe, just within the last few days, there's been an attempt to exhume the body. And there was actually a GoFundMe account that was created by people to try and force the government to go and investigate it. Well, now SLED, which is the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, is now reopening the death of Stephen Smith. They are also looking into opening again Gloria Satterfield's death, right, on that whole, did she really fall or was she actually murdered? And then obviously Mallory Beach's case, which was interesting. If you look at Mallory Beach's death, what really interests me there, Mark, was the fact that you had people who all knew that Paul Murdaugh was the driver of that boat. But immediately the family had made attempts to make it look like it was somebody else in the boat that was actually driving the boat to minimize that exposure to Paul. But if you look at a lot of the video cams that were going on in that particular boating accident, you can see where there are phone calls made between law enforcement and the Murdaugh family. But you also see them visiting Paul, and basically they're trying to protect him and impede the efforts of law enforcement and as to getting to the bottom of that boating accident. So there was a big lawsuit filed by Mallory Beach's family regarding that particular case. But when you look at the Murdaugh murders, and more specifically Maggie and Paul, you know, it was like, what were the big pieces of evidence that were found in that? Now, one of the things that I think is going to be problematic in the appeal of this case, and I'm assuming that, you know, with all the money that the Murdaugh family has, there's going to be some appeal made on the recent guilty verdicts that were thrown down on Alex. But I would think that one of the major things is that they were allowed to bring in a bunch of financial related crimes,
right,
to the trial, right? One of the things that, you know, you know, there's a saying, right, and judges do this all the time because there's actual statute regarding this, but they always rule in a light most favorable to the prosecution. But you have to ask yourself, to what extent are you going to rule in favor of, right, rule in a favor most in a light most favorable to the prosecution? And so by bringing in that financial crime, what they really were able to do in that trial was really establish like a motive, right? Like he was this money hungry guy. And what he ends up doing is he actually ends up taking the stand. And supposedly he'd been dealing with a 20-year problem of opioids, that he had a problem with painkillers and various drugs. I think meth as well. But what gets really, really crazy in this case is after I believe there's probably some pressure being applied that he's going to be charged with the murders of Alex and Maggie. He actually has somebody that he hires to shoot him.
Right.
So that his son, Buster, can get, you know, a $10 million insurance policy. So it's like this soap opera of soap operas that you can only imagine, you know, like, is any of this believable? And so when you fast forward to this trial going on, as I was saying, right, they allowed this financial crime to come in. But as you and I know, right, because we do this every day, the one thing I think that really convinced the jury as to his guilt was that he lied about not seeing the bodies until after he came back to the ranch. And what was found was that there was a cell phone video that Paul had made that was just a few minutes before what they believed was the timing of the murder. And they used a lot of things like call detail records to kind of identify when these calls were made. And they kind of honed in on like this 8:49 timeframe, I believe was the time. And they found that in this video of Paul, that was just a few minutes before around 4 o'clock. I'm sorry, 4 minutes before this particular deal, that there's a video from Paul where you can hear Alex Murdaugh's voice in the background. And so, you know, I think the jury, you know, when we talk about an investigation like this, you always got to try and say, okay, how does the suspect, how do we tie the suspect to the scene? How do you tie the suspect, the scene to the victims, and then the victim to the suspect? And you can see it, it's what we call the link triangle. And what happens is that we were able to just, you know, when you look at it, law enforcement was able to just really look and see, oh yeah, here's all these call records that link him to the scene. Here's the relationship to the victims. As far as motive, right? I mean, who really knows, right? He's probably the only one that really knows why he killed his wife. Did she discover that he had a, you know, a drug problem? You know, there's been a lot of arguments right now and rumors about how does somebody burn through millions of dollars in a drug habit in just a few years? And they bring up a very good point, because how do you burn through that? So the question now is, where did these millions of dollars go? Because they were like, you know, you can buy all the drugs every day, 60 pills a day, and you're still not going to go through millions of dollars of drugs. So where was this money, you know, going as well? He actually was taking money from the law firm that his family had actually founded. Just recently, they had actually removed him from the law firm prior to the verdict because of all this money that had been stolen out of various trust accounts. But very, very interesting case. You know, if any of you out there have not, you know, heard or know anything about the Murdaugh murders, I believe there's something actually out on Netflix, and I think there's even one out on HBO where they actually cover, you know, from a factual base, just some of the issues. And I believe it's in the HBO one where they actually talk to some law enforcement officials regarding like the death of Stephen Smith, that, you know, they never felt comfortable about that, that his injuries were not consistent with somebody who had been hit by a car. Just the oddness of the family being on scene, the oddness of the state patrol not being allowed or highway patrol not being allowed to investigate, you know, that particular death. The whole Gloria Satterfield thing was really odd. You know, the fact that she fell down some stairs and ended up dead. Again, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, that Alex killed her, but I am saying that there's, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And if you look at the history of just what's going on, there's a lot of deaths that are going on. And there's a lot of other things that, you know, if you talk to the people in that community, we're talking about a community that probably has less than 10,000 people. They know who actually runs that town. And so, you know, what have they been able to get away with for so many years? Right now, we know of at least two deaths that you know, are very suspicious that need to be looked into. The Mallory Beach case, I think there's no disputing that Paul was in fact the driver of the boat, just based on the injuries of the other people on the boat, the other kids on the boat. And then as far as Paul and Maggie, you know, they've never been able to develop an alternate suspect that I'm aware of. They've, you know, again, not being a part of this case, it's hard to give you a lot of real facts. You know, I can talk about other cases that I've been personally involved in, and I know there's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. You know that as well, Mark, yep. Right? The things that never make its way to the media. But this is a case that is, you know, I remember doing an interview with some national news outlet. And I remember at the time, I'm like, you really need to look at this case in South Carolina, because this case is really interesting. Like, it really goes to the political, right, how the politics of small towns. I mean, we've seen it on a federal level, we've seen it on a state level, even in the big cities, but in these small towns where, you know, you got a century long heir, right, where you have family influence in that community for so many years, you know, as people would say in that low country, that the Murdaughs ran those various counties. And so here we are. He was just recently convicted of the murders of his wife. And so, like I said, there'll probably be an appeal. And then who knows where that goes from there. If he gets another trial, or if there's something that they found within the process that you know, wasn't done right.
Well, with the whole Stephen Smith, one of the problems is State Patrol, typically in every state, has the real experts when it comes to traffic accidents, or, you know, in this case, a hit and run, where he was supposedly hit by a vehicle that was driving down the road and he's left in the middle of the road.
Correct.
Said, you know, some people said it didn't seem consistent with a hit and run.
Well, his car was also, I don't know if I told you this, Mark, but what was interesting, his car was like a few miles away. The gas cap was opened, right? He had a cell phone in his car. He had a cell phone in his car. I mean, what do most kids do when they run out of gas? Mom, dad, can you come get me some gas, or call a good friend? They don't try and walk into the middle of the woods on a back road, right? When he's in completely going in the opposite direction of where there might have been gas or where there might have been help.
Right.
Yeah.
But the state police are the experts.
Right.
And so if there's anybody who's going to walk up to a crime scene, if you want to call it that, a scene, and say, wait a minute, that doesn't look right based on my experience. You know, so if you want to keep something secret or you don't want it solved, in this case, you would not want the state patrol anywhere near that scene. You just want to, you know, say, what, you know what? It's a car accident. You know, let's get this over with and bury him. I'm amazed that he wasn't cremated, you know, to get rid of the evidence.
Yeah.
But I guess his family didn't decide that. So it'll be real interesting at this point, because it seems like it's all been exposed now and it's past the local politics.
Right.
Now the state's kind of looking at it.
Exactly.
See, you know, because it's very difficult for law enforcement. Like, if you don't find a body for 4 or 5 years, those investigations are tough because the evidence is 4 or 5 years old. You lose DNA, you lose all kinds of stuff. It'll be interesting to see if they exhume the body, can they tell exactly kind of what happened based on his bones or what are left. But it's going to be a real challenge years later,
yeah,
to try to rule exactly. But it's interesting, you know, with Buster, do they still have his cell phone records for 4 years ago or 5 years ago or however often? I guess this has been.
Yeah, it's been 8 years.
Smith has been eight years ago.
Yeah.
So, correct. You know, can they get call detail records to show was he in the area or whatever? There's rumors of a relationship that Erdos didn't want out in public. I get that.
Right.
But so there's a lot of things. I think the one thing that everybody can agree on, especially you and I can agree on, this is not over.
No.
The whole Murdaugh thing, even with Alex, you know, if he's got money and everything, he's going to be able to argue about getting a new trial. I mean, everything. And we've seen this. We've worked on retrials before and all kinds of appeal processes. It's very interesting. And if you have money, you can make things happen.
Oh, yeah.
So I would anticipate a good chance of a retrial. Look out in California with Scott
Peterson.
Yeah. Peterson.
See, now that case I could talk about. I was involved in that case.
Yeah, so maybe that's something else we talk about is, you know, because I, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly how that's been resolved. Did he, I don't think he got a retrial, but he got a reconsideration or something?
Yeah, and I believe it was granted. But I mean, you know, when I was involved in that case, Mark, gosh, that was 2006, 2007. But yeah, I mean, that case, from a physical evidence standpoint, that was a rock solid case. I mean, there was some great evidence in that case.
He's getting reconsiderations and stuff.
Yes, he is.
So I don't think the whole Murdaugh family, I think there's more Netflix specials and shows that are probably going to happen about that and all kinds of stuff. So at some point, I do want to talk to you a little bit further about JonBenet. And, you know, you hear where all these old cases, I mean, it's almost like weekly, you hear of a cold case that's solved by going back and looking at the DNA and, you know, but JonBenet and these idiots up in Boulder are like, oh, we're not going to test any of that stuff.
Right.
But that's for another day. We're running out of time. I think we only have about 30 seconds left.
Okay.
So sorry
Thank
that
you
I
didn't have
time, John.
No.
We're both going to be back on Wednesday. I won't be talking politics on Wednesday. We'll see. We'll have a little poll or a pool to see if Donald Trump gets arrested tomorrow. I think that whole thing is just crazy. But I want to really do want to spend some time about a lot of the cases that we've worked on, not talking specifics. Well, no, we're going to talk specifics, but not tell you about the cases of where we've seen where things, you know, weren't handled properly.
Right.
And we'll talk about that on Wednesday. But everybody have a great day. Enjoy your Monday. Go play golf tomorrow. It's supposed to be a great day. And we'll see you Wednesday at 3 o'clock.
Take care. Thanks, Mark.